www.weaponofmass.com for more info. Please support your weapon of mass instruction in Oregon. KBOO.FM. Hit that donate button. $60 minimum donation. Please keep this wonderful thing alive. Don't take it for granted. They are suffering. They had to skip the spring drive. Do you understand that, my listeners, friends? If you love this station, as I do, you're going to go to KBOO.FM, donate for How Trump Stole 2020. This is Greg Palast.
Thank you so much, Greg. Once again, just wonderful talking to you. We really, really, really appreciate your support. We appreciate all the hard work you've done, and we especially appreciate this incredibly timely book just out yesterday, How Trump Stole 2020. Thank you so much. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio.
Bye.
Bye. Sitting here in limbo, but I know we won't belong now. I know we won't belong.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassie, is a documentary film about one man's struggle with schizophrenia and his brutal killing by Portland police. I'm Karen James. We'll remember James Chassie as we listen to his parents, friends, and eyewitnesses to the killing from the film Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassie. We'll also hear an after-film discussion led by film director Brian Lindstrom and film producer Jason Renault with newly elected Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt and Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes of Albina Ministerial Alliance.
My mother-in-law was a nurse, and she says it was the kind of a labor and delivery where the mother or the baby or both would not have survived 50 years ago. And I often think it was a precursor to the troubled life and horrible death that Jim had. He was colicky. He was a very high-strung baby, hyperactive, but he was very bright, very loving.
James had a pretty good childhood from my standpoint. I think he was happy. He got to do a lot of things that he wanted to do. We hiked. He liked that. He liked camping. Nosing around in the woods.
He enjoyed school up until the time I think that he went to junior high school.
His grades and his interest in school just fell like a rocket. And I kind of looked at it like, well, that's the way kids are. This high school thing was something else. It was just like running into something out of Dickens for him. It just was not a culture he could cope with.
My connection with Jim was the band we were in together back in summer of 79. He was a natural performer. Some performers, they have that gift of being able to grab people's attention. It was almost like kind of an energy, like an aura.
There was some unexplainable glow or spirit that you could see that this kid had it going. He was finding his bliss.
This is a hot number, folks.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Do your heroes. Do your heroes. You don't need nobody like to watch some provides. Do your heroes. Do your heroes. They know what it is. They don't know any more than you. Do your heroes. Do your heroes.
Well, it's very unusual that a young person decides that they're going to put out a magazine and thinks the world might be interested in it and illustrates it and shows it to people as his legitimate work.
Little reviews he'd do of shows that he'd seen. I remember one, he couldn't get into the show because he was under 21, so he stood outside and asked people who were coming out of the show, "What did you think of the show?" There'd be a review of the band and then a drawing of them because he didn't have a camera.
He was trying to encourage people. He wanted other people to be creative too. I want to die young. I'm so ugly, feel so down. No, Mr. Lifeguard, please let me drown.
He was totally getting off on his own work. He just thought it was wonderful.
Silence Snow, Secret Snow by Jim Jim. Crush my radio, wreck my TV. Oh no, what'll I do? I see snow. Snow in my room, snow in my room. Reality stays away from my door. I just can't relate anymore. The mailman doesn't come anymore. Took the telephone off the hook. On my bed, I see snow. What'll I do? Oh no. Snow in my room, snow in my room. Silent snow, secret snow. Reality is my only foe.
He could make a comment and really just cut to something that was both humorous and ironic. He was a guy that you'd think he's going to write some great poetry, he's going to do some great art, he's going to grow up and make movies.
Once in a while you would see just the tension on his face, that he was dealing with inner demons, and you had to learn not to take it personal. And the other thing is you had to learn not to try and touch him, you know, like, hey, high five, Jim, because he didn't touch.
He was packing his things in boxes, and we asked him what he was doing, and he said he was going to move downtown with a friend of his. We tried to reason with him and tell him that he belonged in school and living with his family, and he was only 14 years old, and he wouldn't hear any of our advice. So I knew of a psychiatrist to call, and I called him, and he seemed to think Jim was having problems and should be evaluated. Jim was crying out, "The ghosts are chasing me, the ghosts are chasing me."
He had a suitcase that he had sealed with wax and pens and needles. He was trying to keep these demons inside of the suitcase, and he kept it under his bed. So he was frightened all the time. He walked in front of a bus, and a car came around and hit him. He jumped off the Broadway Bridge. Jim was going to kill himself. I didn't know how to stop him. And he didn't know how to stop him. And then when he told me that he was living in hell, he said, "Help me, help me." And it was like, we've got to do something.
He lived in several different foster group homes, but he wasn't real happy in that situation. His ultimate goal was to live independently. He finally got his wish, and the mental health people decided he could live independently. I think he sort of lived in his own little world. He was happy in his own little world. He loved art and music and taking hikes. He loved the simple things in life, like having an ice cream cone or writing a comic or going out to lunch with me. I think he must have gone to the Multnomah County Library practically every day that it was open. He just loved to go there. He told me that he was writing comic books, and he said he would leave them at the public library for people to enjoy. And he was having a great time doing comic books again. He loved Powell's Bookstore, like the little coffee shop attached to it. That would be his ideal situation if he ran into an old friend and could have tea or coffee and talk. He loved that.
He was very quiet, sort of a studious kind of fellow. His behavior was exemplary. I never heard of anybody having any kind of argument or harsh word with him or anything.
Those of us that knew James felt like he was definitely not a person that should have had an engagement with the police.
I used to see him about once every week or every 2 weeks. He'd call me when he was in a mood to do that. But he used to be included in all the family holidays, and we all saw him, but it was always on Jim's terms. He would do fine as long as he took his meds. But if he went off his meds, it would mean he needed hospitalization, and it would be very difficult. Mostly he just had stopped caring for his appearance and his hygiene. That was a dead giveaway. Jim was never like that before. Jim was in a bad shape. He needed to be hospitalized again. We felt he had gone off his meds.
This is Detective Lynn Courtney, Portland Police Bureau. Today's date is September the 20th, 2006. I'm in a detective division conference room on the 13th floor of the Justice Center with Portland Police Officer Christopher Humphreys, and he is present with his attorney.
And I noticed a subject I later identified as Mr. Chassie, James Chassie. He caught my attention initially because he disheveled. I just assumed he was probably transient. He was standing with his back to me. It was really strange. He was doing this like stepping side to side movement with his feet. Stiff legged, very rhythmic.
So we were like, I mean, that's probably a good guy to talk to. He's acting peculiar. There's a lot of transient activity, drug activity.
Deputy Burton says, hey, you.
He turned and looked very frightened. Eyes opened up. And his posture became very rigid.
10 years of being a police officer, and I've never seen anybody look at me like that with the sheer terror in their eyes. I'll never forget seeing that face, and I knew he was going to run.
It was kind of a regular day. It was warm, good fall day. I was working at Blue Hour. It's a restaurant, the Pearl, right on the corner of 13th and Everett. I was a bartender.
I was in Portland to visit my friend Randall Stewart.
It was an unexpected moment of chaos in a very orderly area of town.
I looked up just as the four men were hitting the pavement.
The sound, first and foremost, was extraordinary.
Saw the officers tackle James.
Jim and the three involved officers were all on the ground.
They were trying to get him to lay down, face down.
It literally looked like two people shaking out a rug.
He was clearly very frightened.
I saw knees to the chest, punches to the face.
The officers kicked him.
The officer behind him was striking downward at him.
And slapped him upside the head.
A haymaker, what we call, when you're just bringing your arm all the way back and bring it down on something with the full force.
He's clearly not a dangerous person. He's a frightened person.
Jim was not someone who needed to be confronted with this force.
And what is this?
Then I started hearing click, 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 which was the taser.
He was passed out.
What seemed to be 3 to 5 minutes.
The two officers shared just a glance at each other of, oh, no. That's when I started pleading with people, again, take some pictures here, take some pictures.
After a few minutes, I wondered if he was dead.
The next day, I typed up police arrests in Pearl. First thing that came up was a webpage. I had a picture of James Chassie. He said he died in police custody en route to the hospital, that he had convictions on him. Basically, he was a bad guy. That's the webpage that sparked me to do everything. Okay, this guy died in police custody. Doesn't matter if he had convictions or whatnot, or if he had drugs on him. He was killed by police in broad daylight.
Matt Davis from the Portland Mercury said they received an email.
We got an email the morning after it happened from the barman who'd been working in the restaurant right opposite. We sat down and he brought out his cell phone and he said, oh, I got these pictures.
The image is really striking. It shows Jim passed out on the sidewalk. All of the police officers and safety officers and fire people are gathered around, kind of slightly distant from him, slightly apart from him. They really don't look interested in him at all. Meanwhile, you know, to any onlooker, there's this pretty obviously suffering person sat in the middle of the street there. And the cops are drinking Starbucks coffee. It just communicated how callous a system can be towards an individual human being.
Deputy Dwayne Begoni of the coroner's office came with a nurse from Calroga Terrace where I live. He just says, James Chassie Jr. is no more. And he said that Jim had gotten into an altercation with the police and Jim had lost his life. And he talked about a lot of broken ribs, and he said that perhaps when the police were giving him CPR, the ribs had gotten broken. But it sounded to me like he had been beaten to death.
They had had medics come to check James out.
There was one female paramedic who was attending to Chassie.
That gave me as a witness some hope, that there was some hope in this.
I believe that they called him because they felt like he was not responding to them, that he may have passed out.
And at that point, a cry emerged from Jim.
No, don't leave me. Don't leave me. Don't leave me with these people.
No, come back. Don't go.
Please don't go.
They said that they did vital signs. They found the vital signs to be normal. Then they left. It is my opinion that if he had been transported to the hospital at this point, that he would have had a long recovery, but he probably would have survived.
The Chassie family has endured much heartache since James Chassie died, and for this, I am truly sorry. I personally feel the need to apologize when anyone dies in police custody, regardless of the circumstances, and I apologize to the Chassie family.
At that point, we were only a few weeks into the crisis. This will be fine. This will be fine. We will tell the truth, and then I'll wait for the newspaper or the news to say, okay, the public figured it out.
Every question was, how'd the fall look? They were trying to get the words out of me that the fall is what gave him the injuries that led to his death.
One of the PPP officers sort of did like a flying tackle.
He hit his head hard.
Screaming
in the pitiful way.
You know, don't kill me, don't kill me.
Mercy, mercy.
These were pretty big guys, and this guy wasn't very big.
He was very aggressive and very combative.
What I saw was excessive manhandling.
It looked like James tried to bite one of the officers.
An officer say, don't bite me.
And that officer kicked him a few times.
Hit him three times.
The officer behind him was kicking him in the back of the head, punching him in the face.
With a lot of force.
Taser was going off at the same time, and then seemed to be unconscious for quite a length of time.
This is really awful. This seems excessive.
Their job is really difficult, but I felt it was excessive.
I expect you have all received information from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office that no criminal charges will be filed against either Portland police officer or the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office deputy in the in-custody death case of James Chassie.
I was gobsmacked because it felt so good. The grand jury day felt good. There we were. We were going to all tell what we knew, and we did.
The reality is, when you have a person who is in flight mode and you have an officer whose duty is to catch that person, the result is not always pretty. The use of force is not pretty. The use of force is not something that looks good ever.
I've represented a lot of people over the years in police misconduct cases and a lot of families with people that they've lost due to a death at the hands of the police. I met with Mark and Jim's father, and within a few days, they made the decision to have me represent them in looking into the death of Jim.
He had run away when he was about 19 years old. He had been beaten up by the police, ended up in a mental hospital in Utah. I think from that time on, he had a terrible fear of the police.
Jim happened to be mentally ill, and he happened to get very scared when he saw the police and run. But he wasn't beaten because he was mentally ill, and the cover-up didn't happen because he was mentally ill. It happened because of who the police are and what the police get away with.
The police bureau will launch an internal affairs investigation that goes beyond the scope of the grand jury's investigation, determining whether the officer's actions were within bureau procedures and training standards.
I do wholeheartedly believe, based on my conversations with Officer Humphreys, Deputy Burton, and Sergeant Nice, that all three of them will be cleared. I don't believe for a second that there was ever any ill intent on any of those three persons. I wholeheartedly believe that they were out there doing their job, trying to do it the best that they could. So I'm hoping that they're cleared, and I'm hoping that they can move on.
You said Officer Humphreys came up and tackled him? I believe he wrapped both arms around the subject and just fell forward to the ground. It was just a straight bear hug type tackle.
We know that it's likely that the thing that killed Chassie was the crushing weight of an officer falling on him. So if Humphreys can tell internal affairs detectives that he in fact fell next to Chassie, he avoids implication in his death.
We are here with Port Police Officer Christopher Humphreys, and he is present with his attorney. I give him a really hard shove with my forearms on his back. As we're trained to do on foot pursuits, you either run up behind him and hit him in the back to try and kind of trip up their steps, and that's exactly what it did. I mean, it tripped up his rhythm, and I got maybe one step, and then I just went boom, down right on the ground.
Did you fall on the sidewalk, not on him?
Yeah, I fell on the sidewalk. I went right over and past him.
You don't actually land on him in any way?
No.
But straight after the incident occurred, Humphreys was telling his colleagues in the jail, I tackled him. I think when Humphreys told internal affairs detectives that he pushed Chassie and then fell to the pavement next to Chassie, I think he was lying. I think he fell on top of him, crushed him, and ultimately that's actually what killed him.
I walk back to the area of the tree where Mr. Chassie had been standing, and I yelled to Sergeant Nice, it could be cocaine.
Sergeant Nice told me that he observed the suspect throw something as he was running. I think he assumed it was a crack or crack pipe.
Before you made this accusation out loud, in front of the audience, the people that were there, the bystanders, in front of the paramedics, that I found a rock of cocaine, did you look at it to see if, in fact, it fit the profile of cocaine?
I did. I looked at it.
And you have training in that, don't you?
I do.
And you concluded at that time that it was cocaine. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Then why did you make that allegation?
Why did they yell out, I might have some cocaine here, when they found breadcrumbs in his Safeway bag?
It's because they want the people to think that there was something wrong, that this person is a dangerous criminal, and that justifies the brutality that he just witnessed.
He was passed out.
Unconscious for a good 5 minutes.
Was out for 3 to 5 minutes.
Literally in a pull of his butt. I do remember thinking it was kind of weird that they were, like, tapping him with their foot.
After a few minutes, I wondered if he was dead.
Meanwhile, since they had him knocked out, they handcuffed him.
Hogtied him. That seemed really weird.
It got really somber, and the most amazing thing happened. Chassie kind of started coming to.
EMTs said that he was okay to go to jail. I think the question is, how could somebody who, at that point, probably had a bunch of broken ribs and might even have had a punctured lung be signed off on as being medically okay to go to jail?
Did you tell anyone what had happened? Talk about the AMR people or the firefighters.
I know I didn't advise about the going unconscious.
You did not tell them, did you, that Mr. Chassie had been tackled from behind by a 240-pound officer, did you?
No.
Did you indicate that Mr. Chassie had been knocked to the ground by you with two forearms and he landed hard on the ground?
No.
And that his chest hit the concrete with force?
No, I did not.
Did you indicate to them that anyone had punched or kicked or struck Mr. Chassie?
I don't recall, no.
Did you mention to the paramedic that you thought his shoulder was dislocated?
No, I did not.
I know it would be an issue that a taser had been used.
Did anyone say anything about Mr. Chassie being tased?
I don't recall if I did or not.
Can you imagine not telling the medical provider that you had tackled this person, the person had hit the pavement hard, that you'd struck the person repeatedly, that you'd tasered the person, not telling them that you saw someone either stop breathing or be unconscious for 30 seconds to a minute? Can you imagine not telling the medical provider that? It's incomprehensible that someone wouldn't, unless they didn't care or intended to cover up what was going on, that you wouldn't share that information with the medical providers.
His pulse is going like a race car. I don't think I've ever felt a pulse that fast.
She asked me any drugs or sign of drug use. I said, we might have some cocaine.
She said the police officers found cocaine.
The female ambulance driver said he is probably high, but he is stable.
By not disclosing the physical force used, by not disclosing the lack of consciousness or the lack of breathing for 30 seconds to a minute, and by pointing the paramedics in the direction of drugs, the paramedics thought that he was under the influence of cocaine or some drug. And the fact that he wasn't very responsive, wasn't coherent, was a result of the drug use.
I asked what hospital we're going to go to. He kind of indicated that if the patient's vital signs were within normal limits, he's going to go to jail.
Twice, a female paramedic offered to transport, twice. And I said no for taking this guy to jail.
We had possession of controlled substance charge, felony assault on a police officer, a resist arrest. We had numerous charges, so without any specific reason or desire by an ambulance support to take him to the hospital, he was going to go to jail.
He was scared that he was going to be found out, along with the other officers, to have done something bad to Jim Chassie.
I clearly heard the female paramedic tell Officer Humphreys that the suspect's blood pressure and pulse were normal.
And I said, well, he's good to go. And she's like, yeah. She says, sign here.
They knew they had done something, too, they shouldn't have done. They may not have known how serious the problems were, but they wanted to get rid of this guy. And the way to really get rid of him and not have him looked at by medical people was to dump him into the jail, and hopefully he would then disappear.
When the paramedics packed up their bags, did Mr. Chassie yell, don't leave me, don't leave me?
He did, yes.
Yeah. But you heard him say, don't leave me.
I did.
That's pretty sad, isn't it?
The whole situation's very sad.
But that's very sad, isn't it?
I just said the whole situation's very sad, sir.
Once he's in your patrol car, what happens next?
He's not screaming anymore, but he's doing this gibberish mumble. And I asked, what's your last name? And it was really strange. He mumble, Chelsea. So I go, okay, Mr. Chelsea, do you have a wallet on you? And he goes, I have a wallet. In the wallet is an ID for a James Philip Chassie. If I remember correctly, the identification had some, like maybe a library sticker. We brought him into jail. I remember I just got handcuffs off and I realized he's gone unconscious again. I look over at the deputy and I said, we need to get medical. He passed out on us before.
He stopped breathing for the second time and he's gone into seizures, correct?
That's correct.
That's a change, isn't it?
I would believe so, yes.
Yeah. That's a significant change, isn't it?
Yes.
And did you kneel down, take that spit sock off so you could see whether his eyes were open to assess his vital signs?
I did not know.
You did not?
I did not.
The officers don't disclose to the nurses anything about prior use of force, prior medical problems.
You decided that you were going to take him to Portland Adventist Hospital.
That's correct.
And what did you estimate would be the time it would take?
15, 20 minutes maybe, somewhere around there.
So you have someone who has stopped breathing twice, who has seized, and you are going to transport him 15 or 20 minutes to a hospital?
Yeah, at that point, I mean, the medical unit at the jail didn't seem to be, I mean, assumed that if he would have been in serious distress per them, that they would have dealt with him, but...
Did you tell the nurses that he had stopped breathing once before?
No.
So they may not have had the complete picture.
That's correct.
You ever had a broken rib?
No.
Ever had a bruised rib?
Yes.
Painful?
Yes.
You agree that if Mr. Chassie had 12 or 16 broken ribs when you were carrying him around, that that would have been extremely painful for him?
That would have been painful.
And what's your sense of the noise? Is it anger? Is he in pain? More of a defiant, angry noise. At no point during any of this did I feel like he was making noise in pain.
Think he ever was screaming.
I mean, it's just a choice of words, okay. You know, making that distinction. He was definitely, it was a yell. I like the word yell better.
But instead of putting Chassie into a ambulance, which is what he needed at this point, he was put back in the squad car. Humphreys and Burton stopped the squad car to talk to a sergeant on the way out. Apparently the sergeant wants to know what's going on. Instead of kind of saying, well, we can't stop to talk now, we've got to drive to the hospital, both of them get out to talk to the sergeant.
We pull out of the Sallyport. I'm still hearing him mumbling as we're going through town. We start to get on the freeway. And just as I roll up the window, I hear bonk. I can see that he's leaning up against the passenger side door. And then I realize, I mean, I can't tell if he's breathing or not. We gotta get off.
I turn my lights and siren on and proceed eastbound I-84, take the first exit we come to, which is 33rd.
Pull open the door, I pull off the spit mask.
He's not responding. He's unconscious. It's unclear if he's breathing at this point.
He's still handcuffed and he's still leg cuffed. I pull him out of the car, onto his back, right there on the sidewalk.
Patting him on the head, slapping him in the cheek, yelling his name, slapping the concrete next to his head.
James. Wake up, James. No response. Nothing.
It became pretty clear that he did not have a pulse at that point.
I reached in and started pulling the blood out of his mouth.
I gotta get some oxygen to him, but I don't want to put my lips on his lips. And at that point, there's a bystander.
Asked if we would like to use a defibrillator.
I said, what do you need? And he says, I just need bare skin. And about that time, the machine goes, shock not advised. I told her, and I'm like, no, this is, he's dead. You're sitting there, you know, begging him and God and everybody else, you know, trying to shove life back into him.
The city of Portland has reached a tentative settlement with the family of James Chassie. The total settlement amount of $1.6 million will come from the city of Portland's self-insured reserve and from our excess insurance carrier.
Maybe some good will come out of the case. What good that could come out of the case, I don't know. Maybe just that nobody else would ever have to go through what Jim went through.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Well, welcome to the film discussion of Alien Boy, Life and Death of James Chassie. We have here today filmmaker Brian Lindstrom, newly elected Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt, and my friend the Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes of the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Peace and Justice Reform and the Allen Temple CME Church. Ryan, do you have some questions for Mike about the
sure.
film?
Well, first of all, I just, you know, have to, after seeing the film, just say, you know, our thoughts and prayers are with the Chassie family, and, you know, what a terrible loss, and James, you are remembered. DA-elect Mike Schmidt, can you please tell us, if this happened today, would you envision a different outcome?
Thanks, Brian. You know, watching the film, especially in the context of where we are right now, was challenging. You know, I have to think there would be a different outcome. I think people are more focused on this issue in this immediate moment than ever before. And we have all kinds of conversations going on about police accountability and reform. And I hope that a lot of the discussions that we have are gonna actually focus on some of the things that I think we could have done a lot better when Mr. Chassie was killed. So I do have hope that things would be different today than what we saw in the film.
One of the things that struck me, and I think I can speak for Jason as well, when we made the film, was just the enormous power of the Portland Police Union. And I'm just curious, in the, what now, 6 years since the film was made, 7 years, has that power diminished at all? Is it? I really felt it was like the most powerful political entity in the city, if not the state.
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's power in different ways. One of the powers of the police union is obviously the bargaining agreement and their ability to get terms in the bargaining agreement that make it difficult to hold police officers accountable, to discipline police officers, to how the investigations roll out. So there's that power. And I don't know that in the 6 years since this film, that's diminished much. We're still talking about changes that should be made in the police contract, and the community has had an opportunity to weigh in with, you know, the elected officials and the city council, but it really remains to be seen how successful they can be in getting some accountability measures into that agreement. So there's that power. But then there's the political power of what that union says in terms of who candidates they're backing and positions that they take. And, you know, when I started running for district attorney, some of the advice that I got from people was, you know, hey, do whatever you can to at least neutralize the police union, get them not to be against you, you know, don't take hard positions on things. And, you know, I didn't listen to that advice. And I said what I believed and talked about the things that I wanted to see happening if I was elected DA. And the police union weighed in on the campaign. They donated heavily to my opponent and in his favor. And I was elected with 77% of the vote. So, you know, maybe that's changed. Maybe the political power and the persuasion that they hold over the public opinion has waned since the time of this film.
Can I ask your thoughts on the defund the police movement?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts in terms of I want to keep listening to the conversation, engaging. I don't see an immediate path forward for having zero police in our community. I think there are certain things that we're always going to need police for. I think about, crimes, immediate violence, domestic violence, sexual assault. I mean, we need murders, obviously, we need officers. So I don't know that defund police means we don't have police, right? It means let's reassess what are the things that we are using police officers to do in our community. And I think that's a good conversation to have. Do we need officers to respond to all of the different calls that they are receiving today? Or can we take those responsibilities and put them into a different place? I think about Commissioner Hardesty's and Street Roots, Portland Street Response, right? I think that was an earlier, they didn't call it defund the police, but that was the thought process is, do we need police officers to respond to nonviolent mental health situations? Or are there people that are better equipped to handle those types of calls? I think of police officers like Swiss Army knives. They kind of can handle a lot of situations. Just because they can handle it doesn't necessarily mean they're the best tool for the job always. And so I think defund the police is a critical conversation we should be having in our community in terms of thinking about what is the right tool for the job that we're facing. And we've heard from police officers for a long time that, society's defunding of our mental health institutions, of our not properly funding our addiction treatment, all of those problems, not properly funding educational systems, they're all falling into the net of law enforcement. And I've heard many police officers in Portland across the country saying, we're not the best tools to handle all of society's problems. And so to me, defund the police is calling for a critical reevaluation of where are police officers the right tool for the right job and where can we do something different.
Power being what it is, it's very unusual for an institution to want to voluntarily give up power or money or budget. Do you anticipate the union cooperating and being open to the defund the police movement? And let's just say from the outset, when we say defund the police, we don't mean there would be no budget for police. We just mean exactly as you said, that things like mental illness and addiction would be treated with more community-based organizations that have an expertise in those areas.
I don't know. I haven't talked to Daryl Turner, the current president, or any of their union executive committee on this. So I'd just be speculating. But I think that they are at a moment where they have to consider, whether or not they want to be a part of this conversation and want to be a part of it, or if they're going to oppose and dig in against. Ultimately, they are a union. And unions have a vested interest in having members and growing membership. I think that's a hard, challenging question for unions to say, we want to voluntarily, bring down our numbers in the union. So I don't know where they're going to land at, but we're also at a moment where it's clear when you see how the community feels about policing our community, and then you look at Minneapolis, where they just decided that the city council at least has said that they will start from scratch again with their police department. So, I think that this is a time for very thoughtful consideration of our positions and seeing how can we listen to the community and our community leaders, especially our Black leaders in our community, who have been telling us for a long time that this isn't working or meeting their public safety needs. How can we really legitimately listen to their feedback and act on it? And I think it's going to be a tough question for the union to see how they come out.
Mike, there's people on the outside of the district attorney's office might see that there's an inherent conflict of interest in the district attorney prosecuting police officers, since you work with them on an everyday basis. How do you go about resolving that conflict?
Yeah, Jason, I think that's exactly right. That's one of the things I identified in the campaign as an issue that we need to resolve. And my position was that we ought to bring in an independent agency to handle that prosecution. And in my opinion, the best independent agency to bring in the state of Oregon right now is the Oregon Department of Justice. I have seen other proposals for appointing a special prosecutor in those situations, mm-hmm. and or having a special, maybe even autonomous governmental entity that doesn't currently exist to handle those investigations. I think those could be good things to consider and talk about. But as we are currently constituted, I think the Oregon Department of Justice is best situated because, first of all, they have great attorneys who handle these cases, and they already pick up conflict cases when district attorneys, for some reason, have a conflict in prosecution. You know, for example, if a family member of mine was being prosecuted, we'd bring in probably either someone from DOJ or another district attorney's office. So they already have that expertise. They've already been doing it. And what I particularly like about the Oregon DOJ option is that they are not beholden to local police agencies. The attorney general is a statewide elected official. So it really removes a lot of those incentives and political considerations that I think even district attorneys in other jurisdictions would face if they were to come into Multnomah County and be that independent investigative agency. I don't know that that completely alleviates the underlying issue that police and prosecutors work together. And it's a good thing that police and prosecutors work together on a daily basis. They should be friendly. They should build friendships because most of the time they're on the same team. But when the prosecutor's office is called on to prosecute police officers, that creates a conflict. And I think it's only right, even when DAs are doing everything correctly and by the book and everything the way they should, the community's always going to have a question about whether or not that bias or that, you know, that friendship crept into the decision-making process. And the only way to alleviate that is to have outside independent investigation prosecution.
Yeah, credibility is really has been damaged over the last couple of weeks, and it's hard to really tell how to repair that. The mayor has proposed 19 reform items to begin that process. Most of it has to do with things we've been trying to do already for a while and haven't done very well at. The city has, I don't know, a dozen different committees and councils to advise them about police, and pretty ineffective. How do we begin to re-engender the credibility and trust necessary to do police work?
Yeah, you know, I'm facing, you know, similar thoughts as I think about taking over the district attorney's office. And you know, where my mind always goes is transparency, first and foremost. How do we get the information that what decisions you're making, how you're making those decisions, why you're making those decisions, what the outcomes were? I focused my thoughts and attention at the statewide level on this issue, where we have instituted statewide police profiling data systems so that we can capture every time a police officer makes a stop, their perception of the person's race and ethnicity. And then we can actually start to look and see how decisions are being made. So in the district attorney's office, that'll be my focus, is making my office as transparent as possible. I want to put our data up on a publicly available website or dashboard so you can see the cases being referred to us, what charges are ultimately made, and then how those cases are resolved. I'm more of a prosecutorial, you know, that's my field of expertise, but I got to think there's corollaries into policing that we should be trying to make that as transparent as possible, how they make decisions, especially around discretionary arrests and charging decisions that are more up to the police officer's individual discretion, you know, and tracking those things. And then I think one of the things that we've seen clearly in the George Floyd case is we need to know and have a robust way of tracking officer, you know, complaints or use of force issues or disciplinary issues, not just in the immediate instant, but like across their entire career, so that we can start to be detecting patterns and practices and making sure that information is available and known. I mean, ultimately, police officers are public servants, district attorneys are public servants. I think the community has a right to understand a lot of that information, and hopefully that transparency can help rebuild some trust.
The Chassie story talks about one pathway of credibility damage of the police use of force, but you mentioned another, which is traffic stop data. Dr. Haynes, would you like to step in here? You know a lot about this.
Well, I think our new district attorney is moving in the right direction. I think I totally agree with him that we need a special prosecutor that comes out of the state attorney general office and the Oregon DOJ to be independent and to be able to investigate cases as well as prosecute cases. And so we're certainly on board and target with that. First of all, I want to thank you and the also the director of the film. It has created over the years a consciousness within people of the issues that we are faced with, the police enforcement of the law throughout this country. We often say in the Obama Ministry Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform that this struggle is a marathon and not a sprint. And that's what I try to educate our younger people on, that it's not going to be over in 6 months. It's not going to be over in a year, because you're going to have a backlash that takes place with the police union, and status quo forces are going to return and begin with their propaganda to try to turn the issue away to chaos, looting, and violence, rather than on the issue of having equal treatment within the police forces, in particular in our city, the Portland Police Force. I want to say that James Chassie was a key towards the small increment progress that has taken place within the Portland Police Bureau, because it was a key along with the Aaron Campbell case of bringing in the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Justice, to do an audit of the Portland Police Bureau, where the findings came out that the excessive force and deadly force was used against persons that were mentally ill or perceived to be mentally ill. But there's a backdrop to all of this, in that since 2003 with the Kendra James case, that we started off where 5,000 persons marched for police reform, and that tragic and horrendous shooting of a black female mother by Portland police officers, and the continuous shootings that have taken place, and African American male and women, as well as those with mental illness and perceived with mental illness. There are some things that we have to do, and Mike mentioned quite a few of those things, but the foundation of everything has to center on accountability. If we do not have accountability in both the criminal prosecution as well as the professional, we have decided here in Portland that those two items can go along parallel. They don't have to, you don't have to wait till the criminal prosecution has been done to have the parallel official administrative prosecution to take place, and to decide whether that individual police officer used excessive force or deadly force. And so there, through the DOJ and the federal DOJ, we have lifted up some issues, and there's been incremental progress, but nothing really substantive. Incremental progress in changing the policies, and incremental progress in changing their training, incremental progress in the terms of those city entities like IPR and Citizen Review Board. But to tell the truth, these entities do not have power. And in order to have officers accountable, there needs to be power given. And so the MA Coalition has pushed for a Citizen Review Board with subpoena power to be able to compel officers to testify, and it has to be citizen-driven in order to take that. Also, we've requested that the state stature on the use of deadly force by law enforcement be narrowed, and that instead of being just reasonable, to make it a necessity for officers to be able to use a deadly force or excessive force. And that, I think we have those entities going on, but what the recent case of George Floyd has shown us, that we have officers that care for the community and want to really do community policing, but we also have officers that oppose anyone holding them accountable. And until we can have some accountability, this issue of excessive and deadly force will continue to go on even after the marches have stopped, because one day they will slow down. I've been in a movement, a freedom movement for justice and equality. I marched with King since I was 13 years old. I know that there's a push and there's a counter push, you know, and we are doing the push right now, but there's going to be a counter reactionary by those status quo forces to keep things in check and to continue to support officers that use excessive force and deadly force. And so that's a reality, and any strategy that we have in the movement that's taking place now. And I see the passion out there. I see the mass participation. Anytime you can draw 10,000 people each night, you see that the atmosphere has changed. And we have changed the atmosphere before in the 48-hour rule with the issue of can we interview officers immediately at the incident. And of course, the union has fought that over and over and over again. But we pushed back in the political arena, as Mike said, and we were able to change that those same officers that killed Kendra James went to Applebee that later on and got their stories together, and everybody had the same story of what happened. And so we did that push, and the city council went along with us in terms of eliminating that 48 hours. So yes, the union is powerful financially, but they cannot win in the public. That's why they've lost every major election in the city of candidates that they have chosen, because there is a shift in the public atmosphere, a shift of people becoming conscious and aware that we have to solve this problem. And one of the things Dr. King often tells us, you know, we oppose gradualism. There's an urgency now, not later, an urgency right now. And we must take advantage of this movement with George Floyd movement and his death to push those structural transformations that are needed. The structure itself has to be changed. It has to be changed, you know. And in other terms, there are some things that I agree that police officers do not need to do. They do not need to handle a mental illness cases. They do not need to handle the houseless cases. That should be professional trained people, that money should be shifted to them to handle those kind of cases. And there are some things that they can handle, but we have to understand that there must be some shifting in public fund, because racism is an issue that affects housing, and we see even in the COVID-19 the health disparities, where African American, we're doing two battles at the same time. We're fighting COVID-19 and we're fighting police across the country killing us, okay? And so we're doing two battles on different fronts. And so we must, in turn, continue this struggle and this call. And I urge them don't distort the message with violence, but continue to push the issue nonviolently and be consistently on that issue. And the central part of that issue is accountability. I don't care how much good training you have. I don't care how much de-escalation policy you have. If you don't have accountability to enforce that, we're not going to see the transformation that's needed.
Thank you so much, Dr. Haynes. Thank you for your leadership. Let's see if we have some finishing up statements. If you could make a comment about the film as you've just watched it or seen it recently, Mike, tell us what you thought.
Yeah, you know, I sent Jason a message. I had not seen the film before, and I knew that this, you know, I was going to see it obviously before this conversation, and I was a little bit putting it off because in the context of where we are right now with George Floyd and everything that's been happening in our country, I just thought, boy, you almost need an escape instead of digging into the same, a lot of the same issues again. But you know, as soon as I watched it, I was so thankful that I did and that I did sit through it, because it was just such a crucial reminder that this is an issue that it's not an isolated incident. This has been going on for a long time, and it affects many different people, people with mental illness and addiction and developmental disabilities, Black people. I mean, it just, there's so many good reminders in the film. I think, you know, one of the things that stood out for me the most was just the parallels and the senselessness of the deaths and killings of both Jim and also of George Floyd. And, you know, one over what was potentially public urination, one over which is potentially, and who knows, but maybe some sort of a forgery allegation with a $20 bill. I mean, that, this cannot be an acceptable response in our society to those issues. I think that we have to ask ourselves, you know, at what point do we have to just break off, you know, trying to arrest somebody for something like that and just say, hey, it's not worth the potential harming of the individual. It's not worth the potential harming of the police officer, of people in the public. And we can just say, hey, you know what? If somebody's, you know, shooting up the town, absolutely, I understand it. But if the underlying issue that we're investigating or concerned with is at such a low level, I mean, we just have to ask ourselves, is any use of force acceptable to intercede in that situation? Or do we say, hey, you know, we recognize it, we write it down, we maybe even take a picture and say, we'll address this later. It's not worth escalating these types of issues. That's a conversation that I hope we have in the coming days. And it really was something that just resonated with me after watching the movie, that this, you know, this cannot be acceptable. Use of force for these types of underlying violations cannot be acceptable. I hope that's one of the things I took away.
Yes, to kind of just reflect on what Mike is saying, I think the movie was very analytical with its data and its assessment, but it also drove home that James Chassis was tortured. He was tortured, and I think it drove home that point, just like the torture of George, Brother George, before he died with I Can't Breathe. There was a torturing part, an inhumanity part that took place in the officers with James Chassis as with George Floyd. You know, to beat someone to death and then to bring them to the jailhouse, and then after that to go through a period of waiting is a torturous death. And I think we need to bring that awareness, and I think that awareness came to the screen, that there's an inhumanity in some officers in their terms of treating the houseless and treating community of colors and treating the poor, you know, and treating black men and women. And so, and I think the movie did an excellent job on it.
You have been listening to voices from the film Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassie, and a discussion with Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt and Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes of the Albina Ministerial Alliance. Thank you to film producer Jason Renault for permission to air this audio. Alien Boy is available on Amazon and can be viewed on Amazon Prime. Thank you to our KBOO engineer, and thank you for listening.